content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kevin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Years of Robert Caro by Chris Heath. Spending time with the legendary historian at his newly opened research archives, but not too much time. At 89, he's eager to get back to writing the final volume of his epic Lyndon Johnson biography. Robert Caro has spent most of his life asking questions of others, and he rather prefers it that way. He is gracious and fascinating company, but while he takes evident pride in the work he has done, he's ambivalent about too much talking of himself. Toward the end of our final meeting, he'll mutter with wry good humor, "I never want to use a sentence with I in it again." Recently, Caro has found himself doing quite a few interviews. Most have been to mark the 50th anniversary of the book that made his name, The Power Broker, a 1,162-page biography of the urban planner Robert Moses, the man who, in Caro's persuasive telling, did more to shape 20th-century New York than any elected official. But Caro has also agreed to meet me to discuss the wider arc of his life's work and to show me some of the material in his newly opened archive at the New York Historical, formerly known as the New York Historical Society. More than once, he refers to our encounters as his quote-unquote last interview, which I think is less meant to sound ominous than to signal a resolution to himself. "I'd like to get back to work," he says. The work refers to the singular project he has been engaged in for half a century. On March 25, 1975, following the success of The Power Broker, Caro's publisher, Knopf, announced that Caro would be writing a three-volume biography of Lyndon B. Johnson. Installments were expected every 2 years, beginning in 1977. Its first volume eventually appeared in 1982. By 1990, when the second volume was published, Caro was explaining that the undertaking would actually require 4 volumes. Before the fourth book appeared in 2012, he let it be known that there would now be 5. He's been researching and writing this 5th and final volume ever since. That is the work that Caro, 89, is so keen to resume. "I haven't seen these for like 50 years," Caro says. He is sitting at a table in the reading room of the New York Historical, surrounded by boxes of his past. There are currently around 120 boxes in the collection, an estimated 100 feet of linear feet of material, and he still has more to hand over. The item in front of him now is a notebook from one of his interviews with Robert Moses in 1967 or 1968. Written in capital letters in the middle of the page are 2 words Caro would sometimes write down as a message to himself: "Shut up." "I learned the importance of silence," he says. "People have a need to fill up silence." Caro leafs through the pages, and it all starts coming back. He points to a passage relating to some moment of New York political intrigue, too arcane to even make his book, about Moses' 1929 investigation of the City Trust Company. "This was not a thing no one knows about. I decided to leave it out," he says, as though he still rues every such omission. These are the kinds of things he imagines others might find here. What's the purpose of the archives? To give people the ability to bring to life figures in American history that ought to be brought back to life. There's a lot in these archives if you want to know about America in the mid-20th century, he says. Caro began to consider his archive a few years back. He discovered no shortage of interest. "A lot of places were bidding, and they were going to elevate me to a different economic class," he says. But one of his literary executors, Andre Bernard, relayed a conversation he recently had with the New York Historical. They wanted in, and they were offering to make a permanent exhibition of Caro's work. "Did you say permanent?" Caro recalls asking, and he said yes. "I said, permanent as impermanent?" And he said yes. That's what they say. And I said, take it. Bernard reminded Caro that the financial offer was smaller than that dangled elsewhere. I said, that doesn't matter. Permanent is the thing I want. I ask him whether he has permanent in writing. Yes, he says. In fact, we have in writing that if the building ever burns down and they build another building, I have to have the same number of square feet in an equally prominent place. To be clear, Caro does his best to sidestep every single question about his personal legacy. I don't think in those terms, he insists. I think about how my books are going to be remembered. I do think about that. I think I've learned things about how political power really works. Not how we're taught it in textbooks, but how it works in reality, and how it affects our lives for better or for worse. And I want people to know that, and I don't want just one generation to know it. Caro grew up on Central Park West in New York, the son of a taciturn Polish-Jewish immigrant father and a mother who was frequently ill and died when he was 11. She'd expressed a wish that Caro would go to the elite Horace Mann school, and so he did. There, he says, it all happened by sort of an accident. He only started writing for the school magazine, The Record, toward the end of his junior year. The next thing I knew, they had made me editor of it. At Princeton University, where he majored in English, he wrote for the Daily Princetonian, and as he usually relates it, after graduation, he took a job at the Daily Home News in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in 1957. But digging through old newspaper collections, Caro's own archive doesn't have all his very earliest published writing. I realize the truth is more complicated. He first wrote for the New Brunswick paper in the summer before his final year at Princeton. I don't really remember, he admits. I think I was there a couple of months. What appears to be his first professional byline was published near the bottom of the front page on July 14, 1956. Handed a copy. Caro regrets recalls neither reporting nor writing it. Boy, skunk, get together, then each goes his own way. Describes what happened when some East Brunswick boys caught an infant skunk and put it in a box until the skunk retaliated, as skunks famously do, all over the boys closing the box. A young boy and a young skunk each learned a lesson about the other the hard way Thursday night, the article begins. When class closed, neither seemed anxious for additional homework. That's pretty good, Caro concedes. I like the lead. Caro remembers covering plenty of traffic accidents after taking a permanent job there the next summer. I saw a lot of blood. Before getting home to Trenton after midnight, where he and his wife Ina lived on the third floor above her parents, and where she always waited up with his dinner. But there were other kinds of stories, too. Late 1950s vignettes lost in the mists of memory. For instance, the time he was set to cover the opening of Elvis Presley's movie Loving You to see whether New Brunswick teenagers would reproduce the quote-unquote hysterical rock and roll riots seen elsewhere. They did not. Police discipline was unnecessary, Caro studiously reported. There was, moreover, no vandalism inside the theater. About 5 months into the job, he changed his byline from Robert Caro to Robert A. Caro, the name he would subsequently use for all his books. My mother always wanted me to use my middle name, he explains. His middle name is Allen. In March 1959, Caro was diverted into what might have been a whole other career. Instead, it turned into a pivotal life lesson. His newspaper was so enmeshed with the local Democratic political establishment that come election time, the paper's chief political reporter routinely took a leave of absence to write candidate speeches. This particular year, the reporter fell ill, and Caro was deputed to fill in. Suddenly, he was in politics. Caro supplied the required speeches and even a campaign song. 65 years later, he can still sing part of it to me, setting the names of the five Democratic candidates to the tune of the 19th century standard McNamara's Band. Every so often, the campaign manager and city attorney, Joseph Takis, would pull out a wad of $50 bills, peel off a few, and hand them to Caro. It was more money than he had ever been paid. It seemed like a dream job, but on election day in mid-May, Takis, who seemed to have taken a liking to Caro, invited him on his tour of the polling stations. At each stop, Takis would have a cozy conference with the police overseeing the polls. Then at one stop, it was explained that there had been some trouble that was being dealt with, and Carol watched as black protesters were herded into a police van. As Carol tells it, this was a moment of decision. At the next traffic light, he reached for the door handle. "I just got out of the car without saying anything," he says. He never spoke to Takis again. "I wanted not to be in the car. I wanted to be outside the car with the protesters, and I learned that." That night, Caro says, he started writing letters to what I regarded as good newspapers or crusading newspapers. By September, he had a job in Long Island at Newsday. This all oozes too much selfless nobility. Caro notes that during the job negotiations, when Newsday asked how much he'd made in his previous job, he lied. The figure was $57.50 a week, he remembers, but he bluffed that it was $150. Newsday countered with $100. Gratefully, he accepted. Newsday in Caro's mind is when it all really started. The New Brunswick paper, I tell you, I remember almost nothing about it. Newsday was very vivid from the moment I got there. In the first couple of days, Caro says, he got an education that has served him since. Word came through that a deaf man had parked his car on the Long Island Railroad tracks and had attempted suicide, but had been rescued. Caro jumped into his car and sped off. He was so green and so unfamiliar with Long Island geography that he didn't realize he was heading in the wrong direction. It was only when he saw signs telling him he was entering New York City that he turned around. He eventually reached the hospital where the man was, and from some combination of police and hospital reports and the subject himself, he pieced together that man's story, not just of that day, but of the chain of events that had led to it. He wrote up what he had. "You got a lot of good stuff here," Dick Aurelio, the news editor, told him, "but you don't have a lead." Caro went back to work, and soon he had one. The anxiety that had been building up inside Deaf Joe Pasilico, 50, for 7 years as he watched the fading of his marriage erupted yesterday into a frenzy of desperation. Reading it now, Caro explains why it worked. Instead of just telling what happened, which would have been a deaf man had tried to commit suicide by parking his car on the railroad tracks, this is the lead about what was going on inside him. Next, Aurelio told Caro he needed a suitable second paragraph, and he took me through the story, Caro remembers. "It's like I went to journalism school in one night." At Newsday, Caro would do plenty of typical newspaper reporting, but he made it a name for himself writing multi-part, deep-dive series uncovering some kind of scandal or injustice. The most famous of these, titled Misery Acres, exposed a scam in which people who had bought sites for retirement homes by mail turned out to be buying unlivable remote lots without facilities. Caro visited an area of Arizona desert where he found a duped 74-year-old widow carrying water by hand for a mile and a half to a shack she had built herself from lumber taken from a garbage dump. His reporting triggered Senate committee hearings at which Caro testified in legislation. A smaller article from that period, Anatomy of a $9 Burglary, also sticks out to Caro. And he took a minor crime and unpicked the whole tale of unraveling lives and disintegrating families behind it. I was constantly interested not in the event the police were reporting, but in what built up the human being who created the event, he says. In sorting his materials, the New York Historical Archivists unearthed his typed-up interview notes with the criminal's wife. One particular sheet is now on display at the ongoing Turn Every Page exhibition. It is a different kind of memo to himself, maybe an incongruous one for an ambitious, hungry 24-year-old journalist, a handwritten arrow pointing to the wife's real name, changed in his article, and the words, "Protect her." "I was astonished when I saw it," Caro tells me, "but when I saw it, I remembered that feeling." Students of Robert Caro know of a particularly famous trope of his. In order to write a book, he must first know its final line. Deep into his reporting of The Power Broker, he tells me, "I couldn't figure out how to write it. It was just such a mass of stuff. And then I couldn't see how it all tied together." He says, in sort of a mood of despair. And on June 3, 1967, he attended a dedication ceremony for a park at the site of the 1964 World's Fair. Moses' power was waning by then, but the front two rows were stacked with his old guard loyalists. All his engineers and architects, Caro says, you know, the Moses men, What I remember was that they all had gray heads. Moses alluded to the public's ingratitude to great men, and I remember them nodding, Caro says. Afterward, the men walked past Caro, and he could hear them talking, saying that Moses was right and wondering why people didn't appreciate what Moses had done. And in a phrase stuck in Caro's head that summed it all up, why weren't they grateful? In that instant, Caro says, everything became clear. When I heard that line, I said, oh, that's what this book is all about, he recalls. And he didn't just know how the book would end with a description of the day's events ending with those four words. He could see in a flash, he says, how everything he had learned and everything he was still to write would lead to that point. I knew in that moment how to do the book, and I remember going back to my office and writing an outline as fast as I could. I was abbreviating words because I wanted to get all the words in there. With each subsequent book, Caro has needed to know where it would end before he could launch writing into it. I mean, everybody has their own way of writing, he says. He's careful to clarify that knowing a final line isn't some kind of glib talisman. Somehow that ending tells you what's important and everything that's come before it, even if it's 1,000 pages that came before it, he goes on. Once you have it, everything becomes easy for me. The moment he says this, his chosen adjective, easy, hangs in the air between us. The first volume of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, which is about Johnson's early life leading up to his first failed campaign for public office, took 7 years. A second, Means of Ascent, detailing Johnson's eventual election to the Senate, an election that Caro's groundbreaking research definitively established was stolen, arrived 8 years later. The third, Master of the Senate, about Johnson's years as Senate Majority Leader, came 12 years after that. Then another 10 years before the publication of The Passage of Power, which ends in 1964 after Johnson had assumed the presidency following John F. Kennedy's assassination. That book was published nearly 13 years ago. Easy, I point out, doesn't feel like a sufficient adjective. No, he concedes, he modifies this to much easier. But a short while later, he returns to the subject. I mean, if I made it sound easy, if you saw my office, there's a lot of crumpled up pieces of paper. Caro is accustomed to questions and fearful commentary about when or whether he will complete this fifth volume. Yes, he has had the final words of the book sequestered away for a long time now. Oh, decades ago, he says. But the book is still underway. He remains adamant that he won't change or hurry his process or second-guess the credo that has served him well. I believe you can learn things by just keeping reporting, he says. I mean, I was always taking too long on Newsday. That was my reputation. Caro always takes too long. So even now, he will write a Robert Caro book the way he has always written a Robert Caro book, cutting no corners. And he, like us, will have to discover whether the world will allow him time enough to complete it. Right now, Caro tells me, he is working on a section involving Johnson's passage of Medicare through the Senate in 1965. He's been doing so, he says, for a long time. Talking about stuff like this, Caro's speech hits another gear. It's impossible to miss how captivated he is by every rich detail he has uncovered. He describes to me the web of negotiations and surrounding events he's been investigating, a tale that suggests Johnson in his best light. So you say the story of getting Medicare through is a great story, he says, recapping his process. You didn't know the story at the beginning? You didn't know there was a story at the beginning? Caro begins to lay out a subplot he has had to understand about the motives of Huey Long's son, Russell, a senator on the Finance Committee, and fills out how much subsidy research this is required. This is why my books take so long, he eventually concludes. In February 2019, Caro mentioned in an interview that he had completed 323 pages of the fifth book's manuscript. When I asked him where he is up to now, he says, well, I've done a lot more than that now. I don't expect him to be more specific. But then he continues, well, I'll tell you what pages I'm up to, 951. I ask whether he has a number in his head where he thinks it will top out. No, he says, because I don't know what I'm going to find in Vietnam for one thing. Caro is legendary for going further than normal biographers would typically go, a proclivity epitomized by his reporting on Johnson's childhood in the Texas Hill Country, realizing that he wasn't really understanding the milieu from which Johnson emerged. Carroll and his wife, who has often played a substantial role alongside him as researcher, moved to the area for 3 years. Similarly, Carroll has long said that he doesn't feel able to complete his final volume without spending time in Vietnam. He and his wife had a trip scheduled for the first half of 2020, but they had to postpone it because of the COVID-19 pandemic. I half wonder whether Carroll will tell me that he no longer sees such a trip as feasible, but I should know better. When I finish what I'm writing now, he says, we'll go to Vietnam. I ask him how long he thinks they'll go for, which he elicits a dry laugh. A long time, he says, because what's one of the things I want to do about Vietnam? It's, what's it like to fight in the jungle? I mean, you take 600,000 American boys used to cleanliness, and you're put in this horrible place where you wake up in the morning with these 5-inch leeches under your skin. So that's going to take some time. He also explains in a different way. One of the points of this last book is to show the reader how a great power goes to war, how unjust a great power can be because of its greatness, that you can send 600,000 men to a little country. So I think that's very important, and I guess I say to myself, you know, if you can show people the horror of this, you will have accomplished something. The real decisions about the Vietnam War, Carroll goes on, were made over sherry and this Tuesday lunch at the White House. He was even recently allowed to sit in the room where these Tuesday lunches played out so he could feel how they might have been. But he clearly wants to describe the effects of such decisions on the other side of the world, and not just in the abstract. He compares the Vietnam material to the celebrated 1 mile section of The Power Broker, where Carroll dramatized the repercussions for individual people when Robert Moses built something like a new road, in this case the Cross Bronx Expressway, by routing it through existing communities, in this case a 1 mile stretch of cutting through the East Tremont neighborhood of the Bronx. To write the section, Carroll tracked down and interviewed everyone he could trace from the displaced and destroyed communities. This is precisely the kind of storytelling that Carroll feels is so important. They're all talking about, oh, there was a great human cost of building this road. And I'm saying, but not one book, not one magazine article has ever examined what the human cost is. I said, I'm going to do that. Exactly what he might seek in Vietnam, where the human cost is perhaps less unexamined. Isn't clear yet, but it's part of the story he feels compelled to tell. It's not just Robert Moses who has unchecked power, as you'll see if I ever finish this book, Carroll says. There was an element of unchecked power after Lyndon Johnson starts escalating the Vietnam War. After hearing Carroll talk about what he didn't even know there was to discover about Medicare, events that took place 3 or so years before the end of Johnson's presidency, and more than 7 years before his death, I somewhat gingerly raise a possibility with Carroll that one day in the future he'll say, you know what, this needs to be 6 volumes. Carroll laughs. It's not going to happen, he says, because I'll tell you why, because it's all outlined. It's one book. His presidency is Vietnam and the Great Society. They're not two different things. He's doing Vietnam and doing the Great Society simultaneously. So the book is definitely one book. In this book, there's an ending. I have my ending, and I have all the things leading up to it. It's not just Medicare. In 65, he passes Medicare, Medicaid, 7 different education bills, everything we think of. Student loans, college construction, reforms the immigration bill, and does other stuff. At the same time, he's escalating the Vietnam War. It's one story. Carroll's will specifies that no one else may finish the book for him if he does not finish it. The example he wishes not to follow is William Manchester's, whose 3rd and concluding volume about Winston Churchill was completed by someone else in Carroll's view, lamentably lesser results. For much of the anxious outside commentary I have read concerning Carroll's plans, I think this may have left many people the impression that we all face an all-or-nothing scenario. If Carroll doesn't finish the book, we will see none of it. When I ask him about this, he clarifies that whatever else happens, these 951 pages and counting will be available to see the light of day. I polish as I go, he points out. For anyone doing a math, he typically reckons to type about 400 words a page, so he's already heading towards 400,000 words. Until now, Carroll's books were all edited by the legendary Robert Gottlieb. Their relationship, and all its delightful functions and dysfunctions, was memorably documented in the 2022 film Turn Every Page, directed by Gottlieb's daughter, Lizzie, but Gottlieb died in June 2023. When I ask who will take his place, Carroll says, The answer is I haven't thought about that. I'm not nearly done. When not beset by distractions, Carol keeps to the same work process he has had for decades. He rises early, picking up a croissant and coffee on the way. There, at his nearby office, he has 6 4-drawer cabinets and 1 2-drawer cabinet of Johnson research. According to his deal with the New York Historical, he explains, they own everything I've written in any form, but with the proviso that I can keep it back until I'm done using it. He sits down to work in front of a lamp on which is pinned an index card bearing the words, the only thing that matters is on the page. It's something I believe, he says. I'm a writer. When you get there in the morning, you shouldn't be thinking about anything else. Likewise, when he's set on a particular stretch of the book, he tries to do this every single day. I don't take off days, he says. One of Carol's well-known habits is to record how many words he's written each day. In the Turn Every Page exhibition, you can see marked up calendar from the period when he was working on The Power Broker. Here's how the first half of April 1971 went. 1,200, 1,400, 1,200, 0, 1,000, 1,800, 0, 6, 1,200, 0, lazy, 1,000, 0, 1,000, 400, lazy, 200, lazy, 1,400. Researching Caro's earliest journalism, I stumbled upon a suggestive concordance. On July 3, 1961, the day after Ernest Hemingway's death, Carol wrote a powerful eulogy in Newsday that included the following sentence. At the end of each morning, he would carefully chalk the number of words written that day on a blackboard he kept for the purpose. One morning when I visit Carol in the Central Park West apartment, where he and Ina have lived since 1990, I ask Carol whether Hemingway was the inspiration for his own practice. Yes, he says, very consciously. There are a lot of other things that I took from him, daily routines in particular. Probably the most important one, and it is the most important to my writing, is I always leave when I know the next sentence. Another, every day you write first before you do anything else. That was a rule, and I followed that. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. We will finish this article on our next program, so be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.